Then came gunshots. She couldn't move fast enough. Her limbs weren't working properly. It was as if she were swimming underwater. She struggled down the hallway with jerky, furtive movements. Her pulse was so loud, like a timpani keeping count, as she tried to remember the way out of the clinic. But the sound of footsteps approaching had her grabbing for the nearest doorknob and ducking into a room. She closed the door and locked it and rested her forehead against the cool metal.
"Please," she prayed. "Please, let me live."
George glanced down at the red-headed nurse, who flinched. He would have killed her. He could have killed her to get to the doctor. Except if he killed her, he would also be killing her baby, which would make him no better than the asshole bleeding out on the floor. Frustrated, he looked away and took note for the first time of his surroundings, the procedure room. Had this been where Lil was? Had she been scared? Crying? Had it hurt? He had only met one woman who had ever gotten an abortion. Alice belonged to their church, and she and her husband had just found out that they were going to have a baby when she learned she had lymphoma. The congregation had prayed hard, but that hadn't stopped the advanced cancer diagnosis and the medical necessity to have surgery and start chemo. Pastor Mike had told her that God would understand if she terminated the pregnancy, and it was proven true a year later when she was cancer-free and pregnant again. George remembered how once he had come into the church early one morning during the week to find Alice, now healthy and 8 months pregnant, sitting in a pew and sobbing her heart out. He had never been one for crying women, so he passed her his handkerchief and shifted uncomfortably. "Can I get the pastor for you?" he'd asked. She'd shaken her head.
"Maybe just sit with me?"
It was the last thing George wanted to do, but he lowered himself into the pew. He glanced at her belly. "Guess it won't be long now." Alice started to cry, and he fell all over himself to apologize.
"I know it's a blessing," she sobbed, "but it's not a replacement."
Two, George realized now. He knew two women who had had abortions. Izzy cowered as the gunman turned to her abruptly and dragged her to her feet. A bolt of pain shot through her arm.
"Who else is here?"
he demanded, his breath hot on her face.
"How many people?"
I don't know,"
Izzy stammered. He gave her a hard shake.
"Think, damn it!
I don't know."
She felt like she was made of sawdust.
"Answer me,"
he ordered, waving his gun in her face. He wrenched her arm again, and tears came to her eyes.
"This is everyone," she burst out.
Just like that, he let go of her. She stumbled, managing at the last moment to not fall on top of the doctor's wounded leg. She lay on her side, her eyes shut tight, waiting to wake up from this nightmare. Any minute now she would. Parker would be shaking her shoulder, telling her she'd been making sounds in her sleep, and she would sit up and say,
"I had the most horrible dream."
The shooter sank to his knees. He rubbed the barrel of his gun against his temple as if he had an itch, and this was an extension of his finger. Then he lowered the pistol and stared at it as if he was wondering how the hell it got into his hands. Could she rush him right now? Could she grab the gun and hold it against him? As if he could hear her thoughts, he leveled the gun at her again.
"How can you be pregnant and work here every day and be okay with what happens?"
"Please, you don't understand."
"Shut up. Just shut up. I can't think."
He got up and started to move in a small circle, muttering to himself. Izzy inched toward the doctor. She could tell from the trickle of blood at his leg that he needed a better tourniquet. She felt his neck for a pulse.
What are you doing?
My job, Izzy said.
No.
She looked up at him. I'll do whatever you want. But let me help these people before it's too late. The shooter glanced down at her.
First, you round up everyone else and get them all into one place, the front area, with the couch.
The waiting room. Izzy winced as the shooter dragged her down the hall. They stopped in front of a bathroom.
Open it,
he demanded. And when Izzy hesitated, his fingers bit deeper into her flesh.
Open it!
Please be empty, she thought. With a shaking hand, she pushed open the door and revealed a squat toilet, a pristine sink. No one.
Come on, the shooter said.
He pulled her from the bathroom to the changing room, empty, the recovery room, empty, and the consultation room where the sonograms were done. There, another woman was sprawled on the floor, the social worker at the center. Izzy didn't have to get any closer to know she was dead. Fighting the urge to throw up, she let herself be pulled down the hall. The shooter paused at the one door they hadn't opened yet. Izzy turned the knob, but it was locked. She looked at him, and he cocked the hammer and shot the doorknob clean off the door. Even with her hands belatedly covering them, Izzy felt her ears ringing. When she stepped inside, she saw a pale woman cowering in the corner of the lab, her mouth rounded in a scream. Sound came back in fits and starts. She could hear herself trying to calm the woman down. I'm Izzy, she said.
Joy!
Her gaze darted to the shooter. Izzy tried to redirect the woman's attention.
Are you hurt? I just had bad.
She swallowed.
I was in the recovery room.
He wants us to go to the waiting room, but I need help carrying the doctor who's been wounded. You feel strong enough to help me, Joy? Joy nodded, and they backtracked. Izzy was well aware of the gun pointed at her.
Make it fast, the shooter said.
In the procedure room, Joy froze, staring at the dead nurse. Damn it, Izzy had forgotten to warn her.
Oh my God, oh my God. Oh my God, oh my.
She turned away from the body and gasped.
Dr. Ward?
He was conscious now, but clearly in pain.
Miss Joy, he managed. This is not a goddamn ice cream social, the shooter yelled.
His anger lit a fuse in Izzy. She scrambled around the room, opening drawers and grabbing as much gauze and tape as she could, and shoving it into her scrubs top, which ballooned out with the items where it was tucked into the waistband of her pants. She got to her knees and looped the doctor's arm around her neck, then caught Joy's eye to get her assistance. Joy looped the doctor's other arm around her neck. Together they got him upright and began to drag him down the hall, his leg leaving a trail of blood. As they approached the waiting room, Dr. Ward looked past the reception desk and saw the body of the clinic owner.
Anita,
he moaned, just as the shooter grabbed Izzy by her braid. Tears sprang to her eyes, and she lost her grip on Dr. Ward so that Joy had to bear the bulk of his weight. They tumbled to the floor, the doctor landing on his bad leg. His makeshift tourniquet popped free of its knot, and blood began to run freely. Izzy immediately knelt to fix the tourniquet, but the shooter wouldn't let her.
You're not finished, he said. I want all of them where I can see them.
Joy, Izzy cried out. Tie that tubing. As she spoke, she crawled to Bex, the lady who'd been shot near the reception desk. Janine, the young woman she had ordered to apply pressure to the wound, was still there, pressing down on the injury to slow the flow of blood. Izzy looked up at the gunman. I can't move her.
I'm not the one who cares if she dies.
Gritting her teeth, Izzy dragged Bex, apologizing for causing her pain. Janine watched her struggle for a moment. When Izzy stared at her in disbelief, she scrambled to help. They positioned Bex beside the doctor on the waiting room floor.
Okay, start again with the pressure, Izzy told Janine.
She was young, but it was clear that she was wearing a blonde wig, and not a particularly good one. Chemo? Izzy wondered, and on the heels of that came a wash of empathy. She immediately turned her attention to the doctor again. Joy had wrapped the tubing around his leg and was holding it in place with her hand. Izzy ripped off the bloody pants leg of his scrubs and began to twist it into a rope.
You're not finished, the shooter growled. Check the rest of the rooms.
Izzy's hands stilled as the pistol nudged her between the shoulder blades. Lifting her palms in surrender, she sent a silent plea to Joy to keep her vigil over the doctor and got to her feet again. With sharp, angry strides, she walked to the bathroom that she had gone into earlier to be sick. She flung the door wide.
Empty!
She announced. The shooter didn't come to verify her claim. He couldn't, without turning his back on his hostages. Instead, he stood at a distance with the gun, bouncing his aim between Izzy and the others. She yanked open a supply closet, the only other door in the waiting room. On one side was a pile of boxes and a stack of cleaning supplies. On the other side hung three long white lab coats and a barricade made of a vacuum, a mop, and a bucket. From where she was standing, Izzy could also see two faces, pinched and pale, blinking up at her. One, an older woman, held a finger to her lips. Izzy turned, blocking that side of the closet with her own body.
Empty. Happy now?
She said, and she slammed the door shut. She folded her arms, mustering courage she didn't feel.
Now? Can I go back to doing my job?
For a minute, Ren was sure she was a goner. When that closet door opened, she had turned to stone. She stared up at the woman, who clearly noticed them, but didn't give away their hiding place. She stayed utterly frozen until they were plunged into darkness again, and then felt Olive's fingers gripping hers, papery and powdery, the way old ladies' hands always were. Ren's phone vibrated, and she lifted it in the darkness.
Still safe?
Yes, she texted back to her father.
Where are you?
In a closet.
Alone?
No, she wrote. With Olive. She didn't explain who Olive was. It was enough that her father realized she wasn't sitting here alone and terrified.
Can you see Bex?
No.
Don't move, her father wrote. Don't speak. Listen, and tell me what you hear.
Ren tried, but with the closet doors closed, it was all muffled. There were shots, she wrote after a moment. Aunt Bex fell down. I think it went into her chest.
Which side?
Ren blinked. She tried to think. Where had the red spread? She moved her hand over her own chest, mapping the memory. Right. She realized as she typed it that her father was feeding her hope. The right side of your chest didn't hold your heart. There was a chance that her aunt was still fighting. People were crying, Ren typed. A lady wearing scrubs opened the closet door, and she saw us,
but she made sure he didn't. A warning popped up on her screen. You only have 10% battery left. Would you like to go into save mode? Yes, Ren thought. Yes, I very much would. Dad, she typed. I'm sorry. It had been her decision to get birth control. Her decision to keep that little tidbit of information from her father. Her decision to ask her aunt to bring her here secretly. She waited for her father to absolve her, to say that it was all right, that it wasn't her fault.
Tell me what else is happening, he wrote.
Ren felt something sink inside her. What if she got out of here and things were never the same between the two of them? What if she had broken everything with one mistake? She was going to live, she decided, if only to prove to her father that she could grow up and still be his little girl. Ren started typing. The woman who saw us had blood all over her clothes.
Was she hurt?
I don't think so, Ren wrote, but other people are.
Did you hear the shooter say anything? Did he mention any names? When was the last time you heard the gun go off? How many injured did you see before you went into hiding?
Her father's questions rolled in like thunderclouds, fast and thick. Ren closed her eyes and pressed the power button to darken the screen and save some of the limited juice she had left. She thought instead of all the questions he wasn't asking her.
Why are you in a women's health center in the middle of the school day? Why is your aunt with you? Why didn't you tell me?
Her earliest memory was when she was 4 years old, when she still had a mother and a normal nuclear family. She was at nursery school, and a boy on the playground kissed her smack on the lips underneath the jungle gym that looked like a pirate ship and announced that he wanted to make babies with her. Ren had drawn back her fist and punched him right in the mouth. Her parents were called to school. Her mother was mortified and kept saying that Ren didn't have a violent bone in her body, which made her wonder if other people had violent bones and if they were tucked in among the ribs or pressed down under the foot when you stamped it. Ren, her mother said, what did you do?
I did what Daddy told me to, she answered.
Her father laughed so hard he couldn't stop, and her mother told him to go stand outside, like he was the one in trouble. Her mother wanted to punish her. Her father took her out for the biggest ice cream sundae instead.
Dad, she texted, are you still there? Dot, dot, dot. Dot, dot, dot. Dot, dot, dot.
Always, he wrote, and she exhaled.
The shooter had taken everyone's cell phones and thrown them into the trash. He barricaded the front door with the couch and seats and coffee tables. Breathing hard, he turned around, leveling the gun at the others.
Do what I say, he muttered, and no one will get hurt.
No one else, Izzy corrected under her breath. She knew that he was watching her. His eyes felt like lasers, but Izzy didn't care. She had kept up her end of the bargain, and there were people here who were hurt. She'd be damned if she sat back and let them suffer. Janine still had her hands pressed on Bex's chest. Izzy bent down, trying to see how much the wound was still bleeding. The woman's whisper fell into her ear.
My niece. Closet.
Izzy thought of the two faces, pinched and terrified, that had been staring up at her when she opened those doors at the gunman's directive. She leaned over farther on the pretense of listening to Bex's labored breath.
She's okay, Izzy murmured.
Bex's eyes fluttered closed.
Need to tell Hugh.
Tell me what?
Bex coughed, and then cried out from the pain that must have shot through her lungs and ribs. Izzy tried to distract her, because there was damn little else she could do but keep the woman comfortable.
What do you do, Bex?
Artist, the woman whimpered. Hurts.
I know, Izzy soothed. The less you can move, the better.
She glanced at Janine and silently directed her to maintain her position. I'm going to tend to someone else, Izzy said, but I promise I'll be back. She inched across the carpet to Dr. Ward. The tourniquet that Joy had tied needed to be tighter and more durable.
Vanita, he said softly. She's gone.
Izzy nodded. I'm sorry.
So am I, he murmured. So am I.
He looked over his shoulder as if he could see past the barrier of the front desk where the body lay.
These women, they were all the daughters Vanita never had. Drove her husband crazy how hard she worked at this place. He used to say they'd carry her out of here in a coffin.
His voice broke on the last word.
She would hate knowing that he turned out to be right.
Izzy rolled the fabric from Dr. Ward's pants leg around his thigh and tied it just above the wound. Hold still, doctor, she said. He raised a brow.
You just ripped my scrubs off. I think you can call me Louie, don't you?
Izzy placed a Sharpie she'd found under the couch at the center of the knot, then tied the fabric again. She began to twist the Sharpie, which wound the cotton around, tightening the new tourniquet. The blood flow trickled, stopped. There, she said. That's more like it. She grabbed a roll of tape, awkwardly tugging it with her teeth so that she could secure the tourniquet in place. Then she looked at her wrist. It was just after 12:30. Now the countdown began. She had stopped Dr. Ward from bleeding out, but without arterial flow, there would eventually be ischemic damage to the tissue. If that binding stayed in place longer than 2 hours, there could be muscle or nerve injury. 6 hours, and he would have to have his leg amputated. Maybe by then they'd be rescued. Dr. Ward patted her hand as she finished taping the tourniquet.
We make a good team, he said.
Thank you. He lifted his leg onto a chair so that it would be elevated above his heart. She looked at Bex, still lying on the floor, deathly pale but stable. Now that Izzy didn't have a medical emergency to occupy her hands, they started shaking. She grabbed her right with her left.
I haven't seen you here before, have I?
Dr. Ward murmured. Izzy shook her head. She started to answer, but then hesitated as the shooter passed by, talking to himself under his breath. When he was on the other side of the room, the doctor spoke again.
You got a husband out there worrying about you?
He was speaking quietly, creating a bubble of conversation just big enough for the two of them. No, she said. Just a boyfriend.
Just a boyfriend, he teased.
Maybe a fiancé.
Maybe like you can't remember?
Dr. Ward chuckled.
Or maybe like you haven't decided yet.
It's complicated.
Girl, I got nothing but time, Dr. Ward grinned.
It's not that easy. We come from really different places, Izzy explained.
Palestine and Israel?
What? No.
Mars and Venus?
Dr. Ward asked.
Union and Confederacy?
Parker grew up eating caviar.
I grew up eating when we had enough money for food. Immediately, Izzy flushed beet red. She didn't talk about her upbringing. She tried on a daily basis to forget it. She and Parker had been together for 3 years. They hardly ever fought, and when they did, it always came down to the difference in their backgrounds. There was the time they had only been dating for a few weeks when she had come across him scrolling through social media on his phone. He'd murmured, "Valencia looks nice." "Let me guess, she's someone you went to school with." Jealousy had bristled through Izzy. Women with names like that had trust funds and ski instructors. Parker held out his phone to show her that it was the name of the new Instagram filter.
"Someone's jealous," he had teased.
"I told you I'm not perfect."
"Nope," Parker had said, "but you're perfect for me."
Another time they had just moved in together, and he'd put his glass on the coffee table they had just bought at a yard sale. "How could you not use a coaster?" she'd snapped.
"It's a $20 table," he had said, incredulous.
Izzy could not imagine spending that much on an item and not treating it like it was precious. "Exactly," she'd said. All the fight had gone out of him.
"I'm an asshole," he had told her, and she never caught him without a coaster again.
She knew damn well why she had fallen for Parker. She just couldn't, for the life of her, understand why he had fallen for her. One day, Parker would be embarrassed by her in the company of his friends when she did something that revealed her upbringing. Or he would leave her, and she'd be broken. Better to be the one to do the breaking. Dr. Ward reached for her steady hand.
"Well, look at that," he said. "Someone's forgotten to be scared."
During this whispered conversation, which they might have been having anywhere and any time, rather than in the middle of a hostage crisis, Izzy had stopped shaking.
"What do you think he's going to do to us?" she whispered.
"I don't know," the doctor replied, "but I do know you're going to survive it." He winked at her. "You can't leave that poor boy of yours hanging."
"You don't know the half of it," Izzy thought. Truth be told, Janine had been waiting for this day. She knew God would punish her. She just hadn't thought it would be with quite this much irony. She kept her hands pressed to the chest of the woman who had been shot. If she pushed hard enough, there wasn't any blood. If she pushed hard enough, maybe she could shove back the secret that had been buried so far it felt like a false memory. Janine had not had many friends. Having a brother with Down syndrome was time-consuming. It meant she had to be home after school when her parents were working to be a babysitter. It meant explaining to everyone why Ben had to tag along. And sometimes she just didn't have the energy or inclination. And it also meant defending him against stupid comments people made, calling him the R word, or saying, "But he looks pretty normal," or asking why her mother hadn't had prenatal testing. It was easier to just not have anyone over to the house, to remain a loner in school. Which was why when she was 16, and somehow got paired in biology with the queen bee of the sophomore class, she expected the worst. Instead, Monica took her under her wing, as if she were a clueless little sister, dragging her into the girls' room to teach her how to do a cat's eye with liquid liner, sharing YouTube videos that were supposed to make her laugh. It was the first time she was in on the joke instead of the butt of it, which was why when Monica invited her out on a Friday night, she went. She told her mother that she was studying for her bio midterm with her lab partner, which was only partly a lie. She met Monica, who who gave her a fake ID to use that had belonged to her cousin, who looked like Janine with longer hair, if you squinted hard. They were going to sneak into a frat party at the college. Janine had only drunk wine at communion, and that night's fare was grain alcohol punch. It tasted like Kool-Aid, and there was always a boy pressing another drink into her hand. The night became a collage of images and moments, a red solo cup, a heartbeat made of music, boys who danced so close that the hair on the back of her neck stood up the way it did before a thunderstorm. Their hands on her shoulders, a massage, teeth scraping her neck. The realization that most people, including Monica, had gone home. The green nap of a pool table on her bare thighs. Someone holding her down while another moved between her legs, splitting her in two.
"Don't tell me you don't want this," he said. And while she was trying to figure out whether the answer that would get him off her was a yes or a no, a dick was shoved into her mouth.
When she awakened, alone, bruised and oozing, she pulled down her dress. Her underwear was gone. The sun stabbed at the horizon as she let herself out of the frat house. The lawn was littered with beer cans, and one of the bros was passed out on the porch. She wondered if he had been on her, in her. At that thought, she leaned over and threw up violently until she believed there was nothing left inside. She was wrong about that. She found out she was pregnant the usual way, a skipped period, tender breasts, exhaustion. But beyond all that, she just knew. She could feel them, still inside her, dirty, taking root. No one knew. Monica had only said, "Well, when I left, you were surrounded by guys. You sure looked like you were having fun." Her parents still thought she had been studying. Janine was determined to keep it that way. Where they lived, it was easy. She still had the fake ID. She used it to make the appointment at a clinic in a part of Chicago she had never been to before. She scheduled it during the afternoon when she was supposed to be home watching Ben. "I have to run an errand," she told him. "And if you don't tell Mom, I'll let you watch TV the whole time." She stole money from the jar in the kitchen cabinet that her parents used for emergencies. She took a cab there. They asked at the front desk if there was a father, and Janine did a double take, thinking they meant her dad. Then she realized the father of the baby. But it wasn't a baby to her. It wasn't a human being. It was a wound that had to be closed. The doctor was an Indian woman with perfume that smelled like a garden. There was a pinch and then pressure, and she panicked and kicked her foot out of the stirrup. After that, a nurse came in to help hold her down, and that only made her think about them, and she fought harder. Finally, the doctor sat back and looked at her. "Do you want this?" she asked dispassionately, "or don't you?"
"Don't tell me you don't want this."
She held it together during the procedure and in recovery and afterward when she took another cab home. But when she saw Ben on the porch with their next door neighbor, she panicked. The neighbor picked up a blanket wrapped bundle on the ground.
"Galahad was run over," he said. "I'm really sorry."
Their terrier was supposed to stay in the house unless he was on a leash.
"You were taking a long time, and I went to see if you were back, and he ran outside before I could stop him," Ben said. "He won't wake up."
She wrapped her arms around him. "It's not your fault." Janine took the bundle from her neighbor. It was the first time she had ever held anything dead. Galahad's weight felt slight, as if he were evaporating. That morning she had yelled at him because he was chewing on her sock. She had so many orphaned socks because of that dog, she had taken to wearing them in mismatched pairs. Even now, she had on a blue spotted one and a red one with tiny penguins on it. Janine was sick, thinking about it. Dizzy the way you felt when you perched at the edge of a cliff. That's all that stood between death and life. A single misstep. She carried the dog to the backyard and, using one of her mother's gardening spades, dug a hole. Ben watched. He asked why she was putting Galahad's face into the dirt. She didn't know how to explain life and death to her brother. She didn't know how to keep from thinking that this was her punishment for what she had done. Had the baby inside her been like this, alive one moment, dead the next? It was the first time, the only time, she had thought of it as a person and not a problem. When Janine was finished, her hands black with dirt, she sat down in the backyard and sobbed. That was how her mother found her when she got home from work. She was inconsolable, and everyone in her family thought they knew why. It turned out that if you surgically removed a memory, you might stop feeling for the edges of its scar. You might even come to believe that you had never been raped, had never been pregnant, had never gotten an abortion. The more distance that grew between that day and Janine's future, the more she believed that she was different from other women who had found themselves with an unwanted pregnancy. She had been the victim. She had whitewashed the stain with years of pro-life activism. She didn't think of herself as a hypocrite. That thing inside her had not been a baby. It was something they'd left behind. Janine had pretended that if she never told a soul where she had been that afternoon, it would be like it hadn't happened. But of course, God knew. And that was why this shooting was her fault. Coming here undercover had been a bad idea. It was as if the center were Pandora's box. She'd opened the door and had released all the evil into the world. 99% of Hugh's job as a hostage negotiator involved being a good listener. But this hadn't always been a skill he possessed. When he and Annabelle broke up, she had accused him of constantly interrupting her and not taking her feelings into account. "That's ridiculous," he had blustered, cutting her off mid-sentence. Annabelle had held up her hands as if to say, "I told you so." The space between them had filled with shock, with Hugh's bitter realization that she was right. "Maybe, if you'd let me finish a thought," Anna said into the silence, "I wouldn't have had to find someone else who did." Hugh had not become a negotiator until after Annabelle left him, but he was bound and determined not to make the same mistake in his professional life that he had in his private one. He had been trained to stay calm, even when his adrenaline was pumping. He knew to keep his voice even, to stay engaged with what a person was saying, attuned to every detail. He knew, too, to acknowledge when someone else spoke, to accept, to say, "All right, yes, okay." But he did not say, "I understand," because he understood nothing, particularly what brought any particular person to any particular cliff. It had always been easier for Hugh to be measured and dispassionate during a hostage standoff than he had been with Annabelle. He supposed it was because at work he had nothing personal at stake. Until now.
"McElroy!"
He turned at the sound of the chief's voice.
"What the holy fuck is going on?"
Chief Monroe was still dressed in his coat and tie from his luncheon.
"Hostage situation," Hugh said, I already called in the SWAT team, and we have a name and address, George Goddard. Any priors? No, it seems to be a personal grudge based on information from an eyewitness. He did not say the words that were on the tip of his tongue. The two people I love most in the world are in there. I don't trust anyone but me to get them out. The minute he admitted that, he would be booted off this case. But luckily, part of Hugh's training was knowing how to lie convincingly. The chief looked from the cordoned off clinic to the line of police officers securing the perimeter.
You tell me what you need,
he said, ceding authority to Hugh. I'm good for now, Hugh said, and he lifted a megaphone that had come from one of the cruisers. He was not a fan of throw phones, heavy gator cases that were typically delivered to the front door via an armored vehicle. The cops would retreat while the gunman took in the box and lifted the receiver. Instead, he just needed the shooter to know that he was going to be the one calling him.
Hello, he boomed. This is Detective Lieutenant Hugh McElroy of the Jackson Police. I'm going to call the landline in there in 1 minute.
He held up his cell phone in case anyone was watching through the mirrored windows. In the silence that followed his words, Hugh could hear the symphony of June bugs and the throaty contralto of cars on the highway in the distance. He imagined Ren, hidden in a closet, straining to hear his voice. He was addressing the shooter, but in his heart, he was speaking directly to his daughter.
I just want to talk, Hugh said,
and then he put down the megaphone and dialed. George had always believed himself to be an honorable man, a good Christian, a good father. But what about when being good got you nowhere? When you were still lied to, shit on, when nobody listened to you? They'd listen now. As if he'd willed it, a tinny, amplified voice seeped through the walls of the clinic.
This is Detective Lieutenant Hugh McElroy of the Jackson Police.
He felt it, the electrified optimism that sizzled through the group. Help had arrived. They were not alone. George had known on some subconscious level that it would come to this. Someone would come to save these people. It was up to him to save himself. Once, as a kid, George had found a bloody trail in the woods and traced it to an illegal trap where a coyote had chewed its own leg off to escape. For months after that, he had woken up sweating in the middle of the night, haunted by that severed paw. He'd wondered if the coyote had lived, if it was worth making a sacrifice that great for a fresh start. He didn't blame Lil. She was a child, for God's sake. She didn't know what she was doing. He could easily lay fault at the feet of the people in this clinic who had done it to her. The pistol felt like an extension of his arm, like his own limb. He couldn't chew it off and hope to survive. This was a trap of his own making. On the reception desk, beneath the glitter of shattered glass, the phone began to ring. It was the modern-day equivalent of the trolley problem, that old ethics conundrum. There's a trolley whose brakes have failed barreling down a track. Ahead are five people who are unable to move, and the trolley is going to hit them. You have the ability to pull a lever and swing the trolley to an alternate track. However, on that track, is a single person who is similarly unable to move. Do you let the trolley stay on course and kill five people, or do you pull the lever and kill one person who would otherwise have been safe? Until today, Hugh would have said that the lesser of two evils would be the loss of a single life rather than five lives. But things changed when you had your hand on that lever
and the doomed person on the alternate track was someone you loved. It was as if Bex was on one track and Ren on another. What if trying to engage the shooter via negotiation took so much time that Bex, injured, didn't survive? What if he attempted to get Bex's help quickly, disarming the situation via force, and wound up putting Ren in the line of fire? Hugh dialed the number of the center and listened to it ring and ring and ring. He knew, thanks to Ren, that the lack of response was not because everyone inside had been killed, including the gunman. So he hung up and waited a moment before dialing again. When Ren was born, Hugh had been sure there was something wrong with him. He just couldn't get excited about a drooling, pooping bundle of flesh. Even when people came over to exclaim at her big blue eyes or her thick head of hair, he smiled and nodded and secretly thought she looked like a tiny alien. Of course he adored her. He would have laid down his life for her. He understood the duty that came with being a parent, but not the visceral pull he'd heard others describe. "Just you wait," Bex had told him. And like always, she was right. That miracle had happened when Ren was 3, and her nursery school teacher casually mentioned how cute it was that she and a little boy named Saheed played house together.
"Who's Saheed?"
he had asked that day, driving her home.
"Oh," Ren had said, "my boyfriend."
The first time he had seen Ren on the playground, holding hands with Saheed, Hugh had very clearly felt the world shift. That was the moment he realized that Ren did not belong to him. In fact, Hugh belonged to her. One day, she would not need him to help her decide if she should wear leggings with candy corn on them or foxes. One day she would remember all the words to Bohemian Rhapsody without him filling in the gaps as they sang along in the car. One day she wouldn't ask him to get the goldfish crackers from a shelf she could not reach. One day she would not need him anymore. Sometimes you can't tell how consuming love is until you can see its absence. Sometimes you can't recognize love because it's changed you, like a chimera, so slowly that you didn't witness the transformation. As Hugh watched Saheed following Ren like a loyal subject, he thought of all the crap he had pulled when he was trying to get a girl's attention, and he vowed never to let any guy treat her the way he had treated girls in high school. But he also knew that he couldn't protect her, that she would be heartbroken one day, and he would have to see her cry. That was fatherhood. Fatherhood was wanting to put his daughter in a bubble where she could never be hurt, while knowing that he had hurt someone else's daughter once. Fatherhood was plotting the future murder of a sweet kid named Saheed because he had the wisdom to see that nobody else in the world was as awesome as Ren. Now, Hugh scrolled through forgotten conversations in his mind. In any of them, had Ren mentioned a boy? Ren had said she was here with Bex, but this was an abortion clinic. Bex was too old to need one. Maybe his sister had come here for another reason, but why would she have taken Ren out of school to accompany her? Unless... he couldn't even finish that sentence in his mind. He decided that after he saved Ren's life, he would find out who the boy was, and then maybe kill him. Hugh dialed the phone number of the center again. This time on the third ring, a woman answered, not Ren. But he had made first contact. "Now," he thought, "go. This is Lieutenant McElroy with the Jackson Police. Am I on speakerphone?" "No,"
Who am I speaking with?
My name is Izzy.
Izzy, Hugh said. I'm here to help you. Can I talk to the person who might be able to resolve this situation?
He heard her say to someone, It's the police and they want you. And then,
Yeah.
The voice of the shooter rumbled like a stick drawn across fence posts. Just that one syllable opened a cave Hugh could peer into. The word was deep, boiling, wary. But it was also one word, rather than a barrage of them, which meant he was listening.
This is Detective Hugh McElroy of the Jackson Police Department. I'm with the hostage negotiation unit. I'm here to talk to you and ensure the safety of you and everyone else in the building.
I have nothing to talk about, the shooter said. These people are murderers.
Okay, Hugh replied. No judgment.
An acknowledgement.
What's your name, sir?
He asked, although he already knew.
What would you like to be called?
George.
In the background, Hugh could hear an agonized cry.
Please let it not be Bex, he thought. Are you hurt, George?
I'm fine.
Is anyone else hurt? Does someone need a doctor? It sounds like there might be some people in pain.
They don't deserve help.
Hugh felt the eyes of Chief Monroe and at least a dozen other officers on him. He turned his back. The relationship he needed to build with George Goddard was between the two of them and no one else.
Whatever happened in there, George, you're not to blame. I know that there are other people at fault here. Whatever happened, happened. That's over and done. But you and I can work together now to make sure no one else gets hurt. We can resolve this and help you at the same time.
Hugh waited for a response. But there wasn't one.
Well, it beat fuck you. As long as George was still on the line, he had a chance. Here's my phone number in case we get disconnected, Hugh said.
He rattled off the digits.
I'm the one in charge out here.
Why should I trust you?
George asked.
Well, Hugh said,
having known this question would come.
We haven't stormed the building, have we? My gun is still in my holster, George. I want to work with you. I want us to both get what we want.
You can't give me what I want, George answered.
Try me.
Really?
You could hear the sarcasm in George's voice.
Really?
He confirmed.
Bring my grandchild back to life,
George said, and he hung up the phone. 11 a.m. It wasn't as if the waiting room of the center screamed,
We do abortions here.
It reminded Ren a little of her dentist's office. Bad art on the walls, magazines from the Stone Age, a television playing some dumb talk show. There was a couch and a smattering of chairs, none of which matched. The coffee table had deep grooves in it, as if it had come from a previous careless home. Then again, not everyone was here to have an abortion. She wasn't. Her aunt wasn't. The other woman in the waiting room clearly wasn't either. An older woman with sleek silver hair and red-rimmed eyes. Ren wondered if that woman was making the assumption that she was pregnant, that she had gotten herself in trouble. She was here for the exact opposite reason. Could people tell that she was a virgin? Did hooking up with a guy change you somehow, from the inside out? Would she come downstairs the morning after it happened, and would her father instantly know by looking at her? The thought embarrassed her. What if her dad could tell, and he asked her about it?
Could you pass me the salt? And who the hell did you sleep with?
It wasn't really that she was afraid he'd kill Ryan. He might want to, but he was an officer of the law through and through. It was that for so long, it had just been the two of them. Even though she didn't think things would change and didn't want things to change, it felt like there would always be someone else between them now. The lady at the front desk who had checked her in was chatting with a pink-haired girl who had just come into the center.
Sorry I'm late, Vanita, the girl said.
Thank the Lord you're here. I don't have a single escort out there.
What happened to Sister Donna?
She didn't show, Vanita said. Maybe the Vatican finally got her to quit. Aunt Bex nudged Wren with her shoulder and raised her eyebrows. Wren smirked. An entire conversation without words. It had always been like that between them.
A nun? Bex whispered.
And you thought you were the least likely person to be here, Wren replied. How much school do you think I'm going to miss? Another whole period?
Aren't you here to keep that very thing from happening? Bex smiled. I don't know what you're complaining about. Personally, I am riveted by the reading material.
On the coffee table beside them was a stack of pamphlets. The gynecological visit and exam. What to expect. For parents and male partners and friends. After her abortion.
What is HPV?
There was also a Sharpie marker. Wren hiked her knee up and with the marker began to draw stars on the sole of her Converse sneaker. One star. Two. A constellation. Virgo. Just for the sheer sarcasm. She knew that her aunt wasn't as calm as she was making herself out to be. Aunt Bex had told Wren repeatedly that she didn't feel comfortable coming inside and would drop her off and wait in the parking lot. Until they'd gotten here, that is, and had seen the row of protesters. Then Aunt Bex had decided there was no way she was sending her girl in solo. Last week in Aunt Bex's studio, she had heard something awesome on NPR. For the first time ever, scientists had watched two neutron stars collide over 100 million light years away. It was called a kilonova, and it was such an enormous crash that gravitational waves were created and light was released. The dude being interviewed said that it took a collision of forces that giant to create the particles that made up gold and platinum. Wren thought that was something her dad would love. To know that the most precious materials came from the clashes of titans. She had to remember to tell him that. So she inked a tiny star on the crescent of skin between her thumb and index finger. At dinner, he'd see it and say,
"You're probably going to die of ink poisoning, you know,"
which would remind Wren to tell him about the kilonova. She'd conveniently omit the part about where she was when she'd drawn it on herself. That's what you did for people you loved, right? You protected them from what they didn't want to know. After Olive's appointment, she had walked into the waiting room. Staggered, really. She didn't know how she had gotten from the examination room to here. One minute she had been sitting with Harriet, the nurse practitioner she'd been seeing for years, for her checkups, and trying to absorb what she had been told. Then, just like that, her brain had hit its overload capacity. Somehow she had said goodbye, stood up, walked down the hall, and stood in front of the reception desk, her features blank. Vanita, the lovely woman who ran the center, had come from her desk and wrapped her massive arms tight around Olive. "Miss Olive," she said, "how you holding up?" How could she answer that? Vanita steered her toward a seat in the waiting room, near a young girl who was tapping her foot anxiously.
You don't have to leave yet, Vanita said. You just sit here. Get your bearings.
Olive nodded. It wasn't her bearings that needed readjusting. Her brain, about which she knew more than the vast majority